Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Stephen Herod Buhner, an author of numerous books on plants and herbalism, including The Lost Language of Plants, Sacred Plant Medicine, and the book that introduced me to his work, Sacred and Herbal Healing Beers. This last one is a definite for any homebrewer's library. I interviewed Stephen at the request of my teacher and friend, Ben Wise. Stephen's work was on my radar, but given how many potential guests fill that screen, and the release schedule for the show, it can take time to get to someone. Hearing from listeners, of which Ben is one, helps to change the priorities around a bit and get someone who you're interested in on the show. What intrigued me about Stephen, as you'll hear in our conversation, is his eloquence and broad understanding of various subjects and viewpoint on any position. He spent a lifetime on the path that I intersected at the time of this conversation, and it shows. His pursuits result in a breadth of knowledge and consideration for his interests. When preparing for this interview, I was reading through his website when I encountered this sentence. He is a tireless advocate for the reincorporation of the exploratory artist, independent scholar, amateur naturalist, and citizen scientist in American society, especially as a counterweight to the influence of corporate science and technology. It was that idea that forms the place where we start the conversation. Along the way, we talk about education, sense experiences, the difference between schooling and education, holistic knowledge, community, and to trust the individual genius of people. As always, that recap is only a glimpse of the depth that Stephen shares with us. For those of you who are more familiar with his herbal work, that will need to be a conversation for another time, but there's plenty here to take in and learn from. If you enjoy this and other episodes of the show, please consider making a donation. You can find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support, where you will also find out how to follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. While you're checking this out, take an extra 2 minutes and do two things for me. Leave a review on iTunes, your favorite podcast site, and tell a friend. Everything you do to spread the word helps grow the show. Now then, on to the interview with Stephen. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates. All right, Stephen, if you're ready then, could you give us a little bit of your background and biography, and then we'll move in from there?
Sure. Basically, I never really fit into the boxes of life. And, you know, I don't know that a lot of people actually fit very well into the boxes of life. And most of us, when we're growing up, just don't know that there's options to that. But for me, it just was fairly clear there was a huge conflict between the world that they expected me to fit into and my own inclination. So luckily, I had grown up, I was born in 1952, and the world was very, very different then. It wasn't nearly so technologically focused, not nearly so higher schooling focused. And there were still a lot of people left alive from the 19th century who had been born prior to most of the technology we take for granted. And I knew four of my great grandparents, and with two of them I was particularly close. They were born in the 1880s. And I spent a lot of time with them on their farm in Indiana and just walking in woods and talking. My great-grandfather was a physician who had trained using mostly botanic medicines. And that way of life sort of got inside me. I mean, I remember the Carner grocery store we had was, and it was the big supermarket in Louisville, Kentucky, which is sort of the Ohio River Valley was my home ground then. And I mean, they had farmers come in with wagons, some of them still with horses, that would bring fresh produce, and they had it in this sort of cold room, kept cold with ice, that we would walk in and pick the stuff up. So it was very different, and that sort of closeness to the land and sort of slower pace and less PhD-ish, you know, was really what called to me. And then I came of age and the 1960s, and my immediate family was very unhealthy, very dysfunctional. And so I left home at 16 and went to California. I got there in January 1st, 69. And so I began sort of trying to find a way to live my life where those 19th century values and that kind of closeness of bond and closeness to the earth could be a way of life for me. And I pretty much spent my entire life then sort of finding a way to craft a life out of that, and have done many things, but I've finished 19 books. I'm just starting on my 20th, and I worked as a number of things, working as a woodworker for many years and restoring mansions and furniture, and as a psychotherapist and as an herbalist for about 25 years, and a writer about as long. So that's sort of been my focus. And really, the core of my work has been to look at how individual human beings can find a deep relationship with the earth and at the same time begin to gather knowledge about the world and their place in it, not having to use reductionistic linear thinking, because a lot of the older generations that came before us used a very different kind of cognition than what we think is normal. And that sort of way of being is what I've always found most important. And that's sort of a brief synopsis of my story.
There's something you just touched on there about that idea of a different way of thought. And some of the thinkers that I've been reading lately because of my educational path have been discussing the idea of cleverness being traded for intelligence, that the idea that we know facts and figures about the world is viewed as intelligence as opposed to as a way to connect with the world and think about what's happening and make connections in a holistic way. That's kind of a mouthful as I think through the question as I set it out there. But do you see that kind of a transition from being in that, if you will, like a middle generation between your great-grandparents coming out really 2 centuries ago, their thought process into the modern world?
There were a huge number of differences between then and now. One was a person's value wasn't dependent on what kind of education that they had. And I need to make a distinction between education and schooling. So what kind of schooling that they had. And, you know, my great-grandfather is a physician. I mean, he only went to school for 3 years. Then he apprenticed for a year with a physician, and that was the entire training he had. He worked quite well as a physician for 50 years after that. So most physicians now, my brother's one, and his training lasted 14 years. So that kind of adding more and more complexity on top, it's a thing that sort of gathered steam around 1890, that sort of way of, sort of the Austrian way of education, of everything broken into pieces, and we sort of absorbed that, and it worked pretty well for a while. The problem is there's really inherent software difficulties in that approach that are always going to produce outcomes that are extremely poor in the long run. And so one of the ways I like to get to the distinction, I mean, Einstein said this really cool thing once. He said, we can't use the same kind of thinking that we use to solve the problems that face us. How did that go? We can't use the same kind of thinking that caused the problems that face us to solve them. Okay, so he was making a point, and a lot of people think that what he meant was just to think outside the box. Basically, use the same kind of thinking, but just be more flexible. That's not what he meant at all. I mean, Einstein was extremely clear that his thought processes had virtually nothing to do with the linear kind of analysis that people use now in colleges. And, you know, he used a kind of holistic imagination most of the time. And to him, imagination wasn't a made-up thing. It was a way of perceiving reality in a particular way that was a lot more accurate. John Gardner, the writer, said when he was talking about writing, but it's basically the same kind of thinking process that Einstein used and most artists and natural scientists up until the current day used. John Gardner said, he was describing how it worked, and he said, these are the components of an ancient but still valid way of thinking. And what happens when you think that way is you approach the world with empathy and with a sense of aesthetic unity about the world. You go as a humble person into the world, not as a human being who thinks that the world is controllable. And you let the world speak to you in its terms. And George Washington Carver had this great line. He said, anything will give up its secrets if you love it enough. And it's basically that approach. What happens is, over time, knowledge of the way things work sort of just bursts into awareness in this completely whole form. And unfortunately, for most very good scientists, even now, that's still how it works. It's just not talked about or taught. I mean, Watson and Crick, even though I'm not a huge fan of their orientation, Watson was really clear that the knowledge of the DNA, the structure of DNA, it just burst whole and complete into his mind. He basically had a sort of mild visionary experience in which the world revealed itself to him. If you look at Barbara McClintock's work with corn transposons, and virtually anybody like that, they all talk about it in exactly the same way. So we really are in the midst of a huge paradigm shift. Most people think paradigm shifts are going to be fun, but in fact, paradigm shifts are extremely destructive to cultural stability, because most of the culture is oriented and built around the old paradigm. And as it begins to crumble, people get more hysterical, the government gets more controlling, the economy begins to fluctuate wildly, there's often climate problems that occur at the same time, and there's this huge destructuring of norm as a new paradigm begins to emerge. And we're really starting to find this, there's sort of this emerging different kind of thinking blended in a really unique way with the Enlightenment analysis dynamics that developed after the 18th century, and a really unique form's coming into being. So one of the things I always really encourage people to do is to follow what their heart tells them, follow what feels right to them, because the biggest difference between this kind of thinking I'm touching on and the older linear reductionist thing literally is feeling, and what James Hillman called the rekindling the response of the heart to what's presented to the senses. And that's really how this whole other kind of thinking emerges, not from dissociated mentation, but really from feeling.
That's quite a lot for me to take in, sir.
I'm long-winded. You should know that.
Well, I appreciate that. I was going to say, yes, yes, I do, but no, that sounds too sarcastic. It's one of the things that I appreciate about your work, though, is because there is a detail to it that comes with an eloquence of expression that is pulling together all the pieces. You provide a context, and it's one of the things that, for me, was interesting about this interview, having read a lot of your work, to transition to speaking with you and to hear it directly in your own voice, and the way that that communication varies by hearing that, but seeing how much of it is still very similar to what I was expecting from the written word.
One of the challenges about writing is I can't use hand gestures, body gestures. I can't use vocal intonations. And I have to sort of somehow capture the capacity to communicate depth in just, and very, and really what's really a two-dimensional communication medium. And it's taken a very long time. I began writing in around 1990, so it took me probably 12 years before, in my opinion, I started to become any good at it. The thing is that one of the big motivations for me is the very deep feeling that we needed a better map. And the left has been my tribe ever since, ever since I got arrested for walking with long hair in Texas in 1967. You know, that pretty much gave me an experience of the misuses of power right there. So the thing is, having been immersed in the left and the progressive movement and the New Age and the love and light communities and all of that stuff, the whole alternative world, they were all grasping for something. There was something that moved through the human species in the West in the 60s that really stirred things up. There was some shift that was being demanded by the world of the children at that time. And many of the people could feel it, but the problem in the left has been really extremely poor articulation. I mean, they were searching for a way to talk about something that we feel, and like musicians, we begin to grasp at metaphors to try to communicate that. Like, music is filled with feeling. It's the major thing in America that is filled with feeling. And most people know when you hear a song, if the musician isn't feeling it, it doesn't really sound right. But if a musician's trying to shift the meaning inside that, they might say, well, put some stink on it, you know, or like get a little more growly. They don't actually, many of them, know how to get the metaphors more specific than that. And the left has had that same difficulty. We've actually been trying to use the dominant paradigms, linguistics, reductive linearity, to try to describe this thing that we feel and we're sort of reaching for. And one of the things that's been happening from a number of people is this drive to articulate very exactly what's happening in such a way that when people read the communication, they literally feel what we're talking about, because we're not just talking about a different way of thinking in the linear sense. We're talking about a different form of cognition, a different way of perceiving the world, and a different way of interacting with the world. And the root of that really is, it's a feeling, you know, John Seed, the Australian rainforest activist, referred to it as re-inhabiting our inner being with the world. And when you do that, there's a particular feeling that accompanies it. And that feeling is what tells you how close you are to that kind of cognition. The stronger it becomes, then the more you're sort of in that zone or in that state. So the maps that we're struggling to create, and I'm not the only one working at that, but the maps that we're struggling to create need to be specific enough that anybody can read it and follow what we're saying. I mean, Einstein basically said, the reason I'm quoting him a lot today is because I just finished a new book called Gaia's Mind, and I decided to quote a number of his things in that particular book, so it's still fresh with me. But he said, look, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it.
I have an instructor who has a very similar sentiment, that there's a difference between knowing how and knowing why, and that very often you can teach the how without understanding the why. And we get into discussions of false teachers. And I think about that ability to explain something simply is reflected in some of the conversations that I've had with him. And the difference between knowing, like, the techniques of something versus the principles that lie underneath of it.
And see, both of those should be able to be communicated easily. One of the things that I've found is that none of the things that I discuss, or in other words, everything that I discuss and that I talk with about people, it's stuff that people do every day anyway. Heart perception, or this different kind of cognition, you know, the capacity to feel the world. I mean, for instance, two of the primary examples I use, everybody's had the experience of going into a restaurant with a friend, a restaurant they've never been to before. They both walk in and then they just sort of stop right inside the door and they look at each other and go, God, this place feels weird. Let's leave. Everybody does it. But that simple little thing, that's what rekindling the response of the heart to what's presented to the senses means. It means being able to allow the world to touch you and understand what it's telling you when it does so. That's really the root of this deeper, holistic way of perceiving the world. Everybody's had the experience of seeing a little puppy walk across the floor, and the puppy hasn't quite seen you yet, and it's just smelling the floor, and it's really, you know, maybe 6 or 7 weeks old, and it's so cute, and it's walking, and you just watch it, and then you can't stand it anymore, and you go, here, boy, and the puppy looks up. And right in that minute, you can feel something come from the puppy into you, and something goes from you into the puppy. There's this touching that we don't really have a word for, but it's as real as a lightning strike, you know, or anything else. And the puppy bounds over and the two of you want to do nothing more than to touch each other. That exchange was called aesthesis by the ancient Greeks. They described it as the moment part of your soul essence went into something out in the world, and part of its soul essence came into you, and there was this inner blending of spirit in that moment. I mean, it describes it quite nicely, and they said, right in that moment, what happens is you breathe in. You go, ah, as you feel that thing happen, and the word literally means to breathe in, and they said that's the source of inspiration, when the world, the soul of the world touches you and you take it in. These things have been known for a long time, but somehow we've been convinced that whole dimension of human experience didn't exist, or we made it up, or only, you know, superstitious children would believe it, or not, and all of that ridiculous stuff that the reductive colonialists of the mind have been spreading, you know, for the last 50, 60 years. And the thing is, these things, this way of perceiving the world is something that is absolutely natural in every human being. Children do it all the time. And the important thing to notice is children have to be trained out of doing it. And when they go to school, they're trained out of doing it. But if they weren't, they would keep that capacity to sit under a tree and talk to flowers alive. It was alive to greater or lesser extents in the people I met who had been born in the 19th century, because it's just the way things were. The thing is, many people try to make a lot of this information about how to relate to the world and to deepen personal contact with it, to even be whole in oneself, they try to make it extremely complicated and as if only experts can understand it. And I think that's one of the real problems of our time, that I trust the individual genius of people. And I really, in my experience and all of the study I've done, which has been fairly deep, experts are the reason we're in a lot of the difficulties that we're in. They don't know any better than anybody else the solutions to things. They just have better suits. And Paul Krugman put it nicely, goes, these are times of madness dressed in good suits. And in a lot of ways, that's really accurate.
There are a few points that you raised there that I'd like to touch on. One of the paths that I'm on is because, of, as you say, the experts have better suits, is that among many circles in society now, there's an expectation that you're going to have that suit, that you're going to have that degree, and that there are some people who, if you will, kind of need some of those credentials to walk in certain circles, and that's kind of the path that I found myself on. And in that process, I've been reading the work of some of the environmental education thinkers. If you've encountered David Orr or David Sobel.
Yes.
And it's David Orr talks about the idea, I think it's in Earth in Mind, about how our educational system has become one where we're training children to find a career, where really if we're giving them a good educational experience, we're training them to find a calling, something that has value to them that still allows them to connect with the world and not be thinking about how society's going to value them in dollars and cents.
And yeah, I've read a lot of David Orr's work, and David Newman was one of, about 10 or 12 years ago, was a really seminal thinker for me and helped shift my thinking in a lot of important ways. As time has gone on for me, the thing is that there's a huge confusion between schooling and education. They aren't even remotely related. The function of schooling is two things. It is to primarily train people to be a docile member of this culture. Okay, that's why it was created in essence. And if you go back and look at the mandatory schooling movement, you'll find that there were so many immigrants coming in, they wanted to train everybody to sort of be members of the culture. And that was really the function of it. And the United States was still, even then, fairly cool because most people only went through, you know, 6th to 8th grade, and a lot of people would then go into the trades, and there wasn't any big need for a college degree. I was part of the first generation where a lot of people began to get college degrees. Then the earlier people, the natural scientists that came up before then, Einstein, Barbara McClintock, and James Lovelock, a lot of them may have had advanced degrees, but their training was very different than what happens now. See, my sense, I was brought up believing in a liberal education as opposed to schooling. To become an educated man, to know myself in the great tradition of thinkers, and the Socratic method was really what I responded better to. Finding a trade or a profession was secondary to that or separate from that. So more and more people are being trained to sort of fit into niches in society to get a job and stuff like that. And that's what I mean. We have two very different paradigms in play now, and the one about schooling has gotten very, very strong. A lot of people are finding now, however, as I'm sure you know, that schooling, even with a PhD, doesn't mean that you're going to get a job. And my son, who's 28, most of his friends have gotten advanced degrees. And he said one day, he goes, you know, basically my generation is the first generation of indentured servants the United States has had since the 1700s, because all of them have massive student loans, which they cannot discharge through bankruptcy. So that dynamic doesn't really have anything to do with addressing the world's problems, becoming an educated person, or anything else. There's a certain leveraging of people and economics that has occurred that is antithetical to becoming an educated person. And I found that even in the 60s and early 70s when I was going to college, and I wanted to be a theoretical mathematician, and I realized I was just going to end up working for a university or the government and ending up in weapons research or something that was not going to be any good. So I left that system. And the thing is, the people that I admire most, the people that have created the greatest change that I believe in, all did it outside the system. I mean, you talk a lot about permaculture, and Bill Mollison, he didn't do it inside the system, and he worked very hard to make sure that permaculture would be a thing that no one group could ever control. And he was very articulate and clear about that. Masanobu Fukuoka, who developed the natural way of farming, he wanted a thing anybody could do that no institutions could control. That dynamic is extremely crucial. And when you look at all of the great innovations, like, for instance, if you look even at Freudian psychotherapy, when that whole thing started, all of the people involved in that self-selected themselves. And you have to understand, not one of them was properly trained. That's one of the things that drives the current generations of psychoanalysts crazy. Freud wasn't properly trained, and neither was anybody else that he worked with, that he himself developed the whole field with. And the same is true in permaculture, the same is true in herbalism, the same is true in any innovative field that's been actively working to change the predicament in which we find ourselves. That's why over and over and over I go back again to the individual genius of human beings. That's where the shift begins. The people that are the eccentrics, the people that are unhappy, that are dissatisfied, that go, wait a minute, there's got to be something more than this. John Seed once said, the best way to do it is to preach to the choir, because you preach to the choir and the choir starts to sing louder. And the louder the choir sings, the more people that hear the song. And the more people that hear the song, there's going to be more people that go, I like that song. I want to sing that song too. And the song gets louder and louder and louder. That's how you change the world.
I recently interviewed David Holmgren, and I asked him the question of where does he see permaculture going from here, and the idea of taking it to the mainstream, and his response was very similar to what you just addressed, that it was about finding the people who are already interested, already engaged, give them working models, and just let them kind of do their thing and let it grow.
The thing is, I found all of the time that one of the things that I found the most crucial, and it's taken me a long time to get here, is to realize how ignorant I am as a person, no matter, irrespective of the depth of my study, and how ignorant human beings are and will remain. As soon as we begin to think we know something, then we start to miss what's right in front of us. The thing is, like, when I go out and I teach this stuff, I teach all the stuff I teach, and I tell everybody, look, take whatever of this works for you, go do whatever you want with it, give me credit or don't give me credit. Just take it and do whatever seems right to you. And the thing that happens over the years is people take the seeds of these things, and I never know what piece of it's going to move somebody. And they then begin innovating off of this stuff in ways I never could have possibly imagined would occur. That capacity for innovation is the thing. Those individuals, they live on the land they live on. I don't live there. They're the ones that face the local problems they face. They're the ones that need to generate on-the-ground solutions to the problems that they encounter. The way the Earth works, the way Gaia works as a holistic system, is Gaia sends impulses through the system, and all of the subunits, of which we are one, are the plants, are an eco-range. It doesn't matter what level of complexity you're particularly looking at. Those organisms on the land in that location, they generate the solutions to the problems that Gaia encounters on their own. The world is too complicated for top-down solutions. It always has been, and it always will be. That's one of the problems. And so the individual genius of plants, they solve local ecosystem problems to keep the self-organized system that we call Gaia intact. And they work together. It's this collective that works together, but each one is following their own genius. And when each one is faced with a problem to solve, where the homeostasis, the homeodynamics of the organism, the system is in trouble, they'll have a multiple number of choices they can make to reestablish balance, but they choose. The thing is, every organism chooses. And so that choice has to be left up to the individual genius of that person or organism at the time. So all that happens, I mean, Bill Mollison was very influential for me in his thinking. He's a brilliant man, and I found him to be incredibly humble and willing to be generous in his sharing. But that thing he brought into the world, it's taken on its own life form. And yeah, there's some people that are real reductionistic about it, and some people aren't. But nevertheless, it's doing something in the world based on local problems and local genius. So I think that's the way to go.
Is that why you're encouraging people to take that independent scholar route to become naturalists in their own environment and to be citizen scientists, artists, and just creative people, whatever it is that spark inside of them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what democracy is. That's what the great experiment of the United States was. You have to understand the guild system in Europe was phenomenally rigid when this country was formed. And one of the primary innovations that they had here was anybody could engage in any profession at any time without any training. I mean, it was an amazing concept, and it outraged everybody in Europe. They thought we were barbarians, which we are, which is still great. But the thing is, now we're once more in that guild system again. But the thing is, the United States did just fine for a very long time with that sort of orientation, which really didn't fully change until after World War II, when the United States began to become an imperial power. So the thing is, these innovations that we see, like, for instance, the medical system in the United States is broken. Now, everybody knows it. Many of the doctors I speak to know it. The hospital systems don't work. And one of the things I've been tracking for a long time is resistant bacteria and their exponential growth. And I've read, you know, the work of the leading bacteriologists in the world. And basically, they're all pretty clear that within the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, that antibiotics are going to completely fail, totally, completely, utterly, and they will never be able to be reclaimed as a medical choice. And in that moment, almost all the surgery that happens now will no longer be possible, okay? Minor wounds can become deadly wounds. I mean, the whole medical system will begin to collapse just from that reason alone then. But you have to understand, at the same time that this has been happening, thousands and thousands of people around the United States over the last 30 years have been training as herbalists. You know, I've been asking them for a long time, like, why do you do this? You're spending years and thousands of dollars training in a profession you're not legally able to practice. And every one of them says some version of, I don't know, I just felt like I should. That thing there's a movement that begins to happen of its own many times like that. And that herbal medicine is as sophisticated as technological medicine. In many ways, it's much more sophisticated. It's less good for major crises like war and automobile accidents, but it's much better for treating disease of almost any sort. And it's much more ecologically sustainable. Pharmaceuticals don't biodegrade very well. Some of them don't biodegrade at all. And because every living organism on Earth is basically made up of the same stuff, they affect every living organism just like they affect us. It's destabilizing everything, the trillions upon trillions of pounds of pharmaceuticals put into the ecosystem. It's not sustainable, okay? Herbs do biodegrade. You can grow them yourself. They don't cost anything, okay, if you grow them yourself. In Africa, they've abandoned, many of the cultures have abandoned the Western model. They're finding what herbs work best, how best to prepare them, how best to grow them, and then they're going around giving seeds to all of the villages saying, here's your medicine. That kind of stuff doesn't come out of the system. It comes out of citizen activists, citizen naturalists, citizen philosophers, amateur scientists. That's the way the world works best. And I know everybody's really enamored of the technological world and all the fancy stuff, but it's just not going to work in the long run.
Do you see this movement as a way to build local community, to bring the scale of the systems back to a human level?
You know, coming out of the 60s, the whole concept of community was really huge for all of us back then. And I've explored that in a lot of ways over the last 40 years. And the thing that I've found is that community mostly depends on common need. That most people now, they don't have a common need that binds them together because, you know, there isn't a cobbler down the street making the shoes for everybody. There's not, you know, the carriage maker down the street making the carriages, or the wheelwright making the wagon wheels, or whatever. We're that the way that the industrial production is has broken community bonds, and it doesn't easily come back. But many of these fundamental artisan dynamics are still in play and have still been kept by people who, for whatever reason, feel like that's a thing that they had to do. And as communities get thrown more back on their own resources, yeah, that will really pull people together a lot more. But that the fragmentation that I see, it's not an easy thing to correct. It's literally inherent in the type of thinking that we've been trained in. And Americans are particularly damaged by it. And I think more than any other culture on Earth, we're more dissociated from the world and from each other than any other culture on the Earth because of how we think. There's a reason why we're the most depressed people on the planet, a reason why we have more heart disease than anybody on the planet. And it's because the way we've been trained has isolated us in our own house. So as people began to move outside of those old frames, there is a kind of community that begins to regenerate, but it's not often bounded by geography or time. One of the most powerful communities that I found to be a part of was the herbal community, because there's herbalists practicing every place on this planet. And the thing is, when you've had your life saved by a plant, something changes fundamentally, and you never are the same again. And when you meet somebody else who's been saved by a plant like that, that grew in their backyard, that they made a medicine out of, there's a common bond that begins to be generated. So in a way, the community dynamics that are emerging are different than any that I expected might form. And they're not so much locally focused, but it's a larger dynamic that's somewhat difficult to capture in language.
I'm kind of a child of the electronic age, having had some kind of world-spanning communication system with just the click of a couple buttons, really for almost as early as I can remember. I'm trying to put that through my own mind and in that context of where I come from and the way that the network develops in a community that may not necessarily be physically located in a certain way, but is because of social connections, or, as you say, with the herbalist community and having had your life touched because of a plant, the way that disease can tie people together into organizations where you're trading information and a shared experience because of something that you've personally undergone.
Well, the internet's definitely done some amazing stuff. I mean, the WikiLeaks thing and Anonymous, and there's a number of very powerful democratic movements that have occurred through that medium. And I personally love the internet. It's as a research tool. I mean, I have the greatest library in the world at my fingertips at any moment. And I love email as a communication tool. And I much prefer using a computer rather than a typewriter. Oh, Lord, I never want to go back to a typewriter and carbon copies and all of that ancient stuff. But one of the things I've been looking at for an incredibly long time, since I started out working in theoretical mathematics and then end up working as a psychotherapist for a long time, the thing is that those things are both very divorced from the earth. There's not a lot of earth bond with not a lot of earth connection. So it's possible to experience the self as consciousness harnessed the flesh, as Susan Sontag once rather horribly put it. And the thing is, many people experience themselves that way, as consciousness harnessed to flesh. So there's this dissociation between mind and body. And that is a huge aspect of the difficulty that we face, because most people have very little sense of the earth as a foundational support mechanism upon which all life on this planet depends. I mean, there's really the belief that it's possible to live without the earth, you know, and that thinking literally is insane. I found that when I started to work with herbal medicines and I started spending a lot of time in location on wild land, in wild landscapes for a long period of time, there was a fundamental shift that began to occur. And I've been interested tremendously, really, in two things. What does it mean to be a human being? I mean, literally, what does that mean? And secondly, what is the scenario in which we find ourselves? See, most of us are trained to believe that we're in a place. And that's not actually accurate. We're in a scenario. And Buckminster Fuller was the first one I ever read who talked about that. He said, look, it's possible to get out of a place. It's not possible to get out of a scenario. The universe is a scenario. And once you start to understand that it's a scenario that's fundamentally dependent on the self-organization of matter of which we're a part, consciousness arises because of the spontaneous self-organization of matter into particular forms to fulfill ecological function. Once you begin to understand that, the whole sort of consciousness harnessed to flesh thing begins to, you know, appear as the psychosis that it really is. So for me, that somehow that the reconnection to earth, to the fundamental ground of being from which we all have emerged, to really sustainably inhabit this place, this scenario, to exist in the scenario sustainably, that experience, which was common in every culture on earth up until about 100 years ago, needs to be reclaimed. And, you know, the thing is, Robert Heinlein put it, population problems have a horrible way of solving themselves. So the wild gyrations in ecosystem function that we're starting to experience, they're not going to stop. It's really because of the inaccuracy of the software that we have to the real world that we're engaging in continual behaviors as a species. The earth is not in trouble. Our civilization is in trouble. And I'm not even really sure people are in trouble. but our civilization and the population density we have are definitely in trouble. So somehow we have to reconnect to that ground of being, because it's where life comes from. I mean, we come from it, we go back to it, and that's the way it is, and that's the way it's always going to be. So the people that I speak to, the choir that I preach to, you might say, are the people that somehow feel that somehow, and they're somehow called in that way to do something. They may not know what it is, but the thing is, if they follow that feeling wherever it leads them, it will always take them to the thing that they're meant to do. I've watched that in people for over 40 years now, and it is always true.
You've provided me with so much in our conversation today that I'm going to need to sit and ruminate on for a while. And I hope that for all the listeners, they can take something away from this to be able to find their own path to answer some of the questions that they have within themselves, those who are looking especially to make a transition to a different life. And thank you for everything that you've given to me in this conversation.
You're welcome. I really appreciate you having me on.
Before we draw this to a close, is there anything else that you'd like to add to the conversation for the listeners?
The thing I always end up with is trust yourself. You live inside your life. Nobody else does. And when you're on your deathbed looking back, you have to know that you've left nothing undone, that you've done everything that you're here to do. And the only way to find those things is to follow where your feelings lead you. I and everybody else need you to find your own individual genius and do the thing you're here to do, because there is literally no way we're going to get out of this without everybody doing that.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for taking this time. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're really welcome.
I look forward to sitting down and listening to all this again as I edit, and then again once it's all together, because I think I'm going to be listening to this a couple times and revisiting over time moving forward to see if I really get everything that you shared with us today.
Well, be well, and I really appreciate you asking me to be on.
And that was Stephen Harrod-Buhner. Though, as you heard, I'm still contemplating many of the ideas we covered in this interview. Some points stand out to me at this immediate moment. The first is that Stephen found his own way and has been crafting a life out of it ever since. Though the path has crossed many different jobs along the way, his direction continues ever onward. As many of you heard in my story of coming to permaculture, there are many ways to get where you want to go, so long as you remember the goal, and as you keep that in mind to enjoy the trip along the way. The second is in trusting the individual genius of people. We all have gifts or talents that may be going untapped in our day-to-day lives, but that can be rekindled. You can reconnect with your own life, your community, however that's defined, and with the earth to live the life that you want. I'm reminded of the interview with Pam Warhurst when we spoke about the idea of trusting people, which is something that I find doesn't always happen. And too often it's that we're not trusting ourselves. If we want to build a better world, we have to trust ourselves and each other. Third is that as you trust that genius and yourself to find your own education and become the educated person you can be in your own right. For some, that may require schooling because of the niche that they fill, or be more open to read, write, and discuss with others, to ask questions, consider them critically, and to find your own answers, to become that citizen artist, philosopher, or scientist that finds more connections about the world and the way we can think differently. The last point is to reinforce that idea of self-trust. As Stephen said, to trust your own feelings. We have a role to play in this greater world, and to find our own satisfaction. Society doesn't value all these things equally, or in some cases at all. So you may not be able to make a living at your passion, but that doesn't mean that because it doesn't make dollars, that it doesn't make sense. In whatever way you use the information and ideas presented in this interview or any other episode of the podcast, remember to never let discouragement set you off the path. If you're really discouraged, maybe you pause, stop for a little bit, and consider how you take your next step, but that you do then act and take that next step. There are many stories of success that forget to mention the failures that happened along the way and the persistence that's required to continually move forward and to find your successes in each day and each moment, and as you do, to build the confidence to continue onward. As I said in my own tale about coming to permaculture, it took me over 15 years to get to the point where I could even consider the road that I'm currently on, and I've still got a long way to go yet. But I'm glad that you're along with me for this journey. If you ever have any questions or comments, or there's any way that I can help you on your path with permaculture, never hesitate to contact me. Email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or give me a call, 717-827-6266. From here, things are still up in the air as I'm wrapping up a few projects and setting up the next round of interviews. The next topical series I have planned is to expand on the conversation with my friend Aaron Harvey about farming and starting a farm by talking with several people I know who have done that, which includes some candor on their trials and road bumps along the way. Also included in those conversations are sustainable agriculture, urban farming, starting a farm after you've already completed a career, coming to farming later in life, if you will, and also about rotational grazing and family farming. I also recently interviewed with Lillian Brummett of the Conscious Decision Radio Show. If you want to hear what I sound like live and unscripted and feeling a little bit out of my element being on the other side of the microphone as a guest instead of a host, you can hear me ramble on in the archived episode of that show, which I'll be sharing a link to in the next few days. On Friday, April 26th, I'm attending a workshop on farm-scale charcoal production and biochar being taught by a forester from Penn State, our local land-grant university that runs the extension offices, which I talked with Stephen Gabriel about. And this event is being offered through the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. I plan to take plenty of notes and pictures while I'm there, so expect something from that at the end of April or beginning of May. And, dear listener, that brings us to a close for this episode. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.